Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And I don't know how long you've been listening to us, but surely you know by now that Peter is a very smart and very funny person.
Oh, I am?
Yes.
What do I do now?
Well, you thought up this ingenious theme for today's program, which is books you never expected anybody would write.
Exactly. I will explain the reason why we think that. It turns out they're all very, very interesting volumes and really rather significant and important and interesting, all of the above. But if somebody had come to me as a publisher and said, I want to write the book about this, I would have been like the guy at Decca Records who turned down the Beatles when they came with their demo tape. And of course, they went off to EMI instead and the rest is history. So I would feel a little bit like that, but Sam Killigioni, he's an old friend.
Yes.
And he's been with us before from Dogfish Head Brewery in Delaware. But this time he decided not to write a book about beer, although it's sort of a little bit like beer in the background. He wrote a book about management theory, management and how he had learned to be successful. And you can learn to be successful in the same way by listening to what he said. Right?
Right. Sam Calagione, I suddenly realize how young you were when we talked to you when you first started your company.
I don't feel so young anymore.
Well, I mean, you were very young to do that. I mean, you took up this movement head on and blasted it into outer space. You made the whole movement yourself.
Well, you know, Doug, we're very proud of Dogfish Head's position as innovators and leaders in the world of craft brewing, but we certainly had some great peers that started before us. I think of Sierra Nevada Brewery and
yes.
Sam Adams and Anchor Steam, and they really set the trail. But I think, you know, what I'm most proud of in Dogfish Head's history is we were really the first brewery to focus on brewing beers outside of traditional stylistic guidelines, bringing in culinary ingredients into everyday beers. So we are very proud of our role, as we are of the roles of our other brothers and sisters that have made this such a vibrant marketplace.
The book is called Off-Centered Leadership, and it hits right on the mark for where you are, because the whole field is going to be changing, isn't it?
Yes, craft brewing competitive space is changing rapidly, with once true indie craft breweries selling out to the world's biggest brewing conglomerate and two new craft breweries entering the marketplace every day. So there's competitive pressures from smaller breweries, competitive pressures from the world's biggest breweries, but the great breweries, regardless of scale, the ones that are maniacally focused on quality, consistency, and being well differentiated are the ones that are going to win the consumers' votes as they vote with their wallets and their pocketbooks.
Now, the interesting thing, Sam, is that this book is mostly not about beer at all. It's about business concepts and how you grow a business doing anything. What was it that made you think you had a story to tell that was worth publishing about that aspect of your career?
Well, I mean, that's a great question, and my first book was more focused specifically on our brand of Dogfish and our beers and the products that we make. But the more I have been out there selling our beer and talking with other entrepreneurs in different industries, I felt that the growing pains and challenges and rewards that we were going through at Dogfish as a company and as a leadership team probably hold value for other entrepreneurs or leaders within organizations, regardless of whether they're for-profit or non-profit organizations. Anyone that's part of a growing and evolving leadership team, I'm hopeful that there's information from what we've learned in our journey at Dogfish that can be applied to any organization or growing business.
Now, you learned some really important lessons along the way. Perhaps you can mention just two or three of those, which are, because you're a big enough guy to say, I can criticize myself, and I can allow other people to criticize me as well, because I know I've done something's wrong. What are some of those things?
Well, I would say, you know, getting consensus from your whole leadership team on major initiatives, projects, strategies, even if you work at a company that you are own the controlling interest of, as Mariah, my wife, and I are, you know, have control of our family company, Dogfish Head. But we work, you know, shoulder to shoulder with other leaders at our company, very talented leaders whose skills complement our own, our CEO, Nick Benz, our HR director, Cindy, our marketing VP, Neil. And in earlier era, I wasn't always as thoughtful about getting consensus from the leadership team before embarking on a new product or project launch. And sometimes that, you know, can affect the level of buy-in and commitment and sense of ownership and pride in the project by everybody who has to be involved in carrying it through to fruition. So as we're learning to do that, we now are more sensitive and intentional with a consensus building approach where we use a show of thumbs. If a major decision's on the table, we pitch it, we put it forward, and we say a show of thumbs. Who thumbs up supports this decision? Who's thumbs sideways, which means I can live with it, but I don't necessarily like it, but I'll leave this room 100% supporting the team. Or thumbs down, which means I can't live with this decision. And in that case, we don't move forward with it. We debate and talk about and refine an idea until at least the majority of thumbs are up. And if we have to occasionally live with some thumbs sideways positions, we'll do that. But thumbs down is not an option to move forward anymore on a project or product at Dogfish Head.
Now, the interesting thing is that I guess most people believe that the thumbs up, thumbs down thing was originally invented and developed by the emperors at Rome at their gladiator contests. Thumbs down meant the gladiator survived and went on to fight again. Thumbs up said it was all right to kill him.
Yeah.
So I guess thumbs up fits well in your scenario, but with perhaps a slightly different distinction. Now, everybody has an acronym. You have a lot of wonderful thoughts, but you have to have an acronym, and yours is DISC. I probably have them in the wrong order. Talk to us about what those mean and how they interact.
DISC analysis is not anything that we have come up with, but it's something that Dogfish is really enjoying the journey of implementing into our leadership process. And without getting too technical, I'll say that the concept is owned by Wiley Publishing, the DISC concept.
Okay.
And what it means is you, as a leadership team, you can take a DISC test, and it will tell you where on sort of a spectrum of leadership inclinations you might have. So you might have someone who's more of a team builder and a consensus builder. You might have someone who likes to process and analyze and not make quick, rash decisions. It's almost, you know, irrelevant where people fall in the spectrum, except to say that taking this test shows you where each person does fall in this sort of circle of different approaches, and then it teaches you how you, wherever you fall, in whatever quadrant of the circle you fall, how you interact with a person, say, across the spectrum from you. So if you're a rash, impetuous, action-oriented decision maker, you know, the way that you interact with another leader that's similar to you, where you basically speak shorthand because your inclinations are so similar, is going to be very different from another leader on your team that might be on the opposite end of the spectrum. They might be risk-averse. They might be people that take a ton of time to process an idea before they're willing to comment to on their position. So the DISC process I recommend to any leadership team in a way that really reveals the leadership temperament and leadership perspective of each voice at that table, and then it gives everyone at the table the knowledge on how best to interact with each other.
Now, you have some fairly lengthy words to say about what it was like to transition as the company grew, what it was like to transition from a business where you made all the decisions because there was nobody else to make them, to the point where you were actually ready to accept that you might make decisions that really weren't the correct ones. How did that happen?
Well, I think just in time, as the leadership company grew and as the overall number of coworkers that work at our company grew, I had to, you know, gain maturity as leader to say, the old way of doing things, which is sort of the fly by the seat of our pants, going by Sam's intuition and Sam's gut as the main trigger of if we're going to do something or not, wasn't really fair to the entire company, and that I had to have the humility to see that more thoughtful, robust, well-rounded decisions would generally come forward I put more faith in a democratic process to vet strategic and creative components to what we were doing among a team instead of just go by that process on a day-to-day operational level is very important to our leadership team and very important to our company. Now we're not, a company where every single person votes on every single thing, but the leadership team having a say in our process is critical, even at the same time that it doesn't change the overall ownership control of our company. We're still a family company, family controlled, but Mariah and I are working hard to give other leaders at our company more input to, strategic and creative operational decisions as the company moves forward.
Now, there are two really important, not to single out, because you would probably say, how many important people are in Dogfish Head? If I asked you that, you'd probably say 230, which is the entire payroll. But there are two people who seem to have been particularly important in the contributions they've made. One of them is your CEO, and the other, shall we call her the vice president of sales, who just happens to have the same last name you do? Perhaps you can comment on how in particular they have helped you so that other people who are facing the same dilemmas you have will know where they can go to get the kind of assistance that they need to do the right thing.
Yeah, well, I would just say as a recommendation to anyone listening who's on their own leadership journey amongst the team and trying to grow a team, the key is to start with yourself and be honest with where your skill sets really lie, because every entrepreneur has to wear a lot of different hats, but many times you wear them out of necessity, not because you're good at what that particular hat needs you to be good at. And in my case, I'm better at coming up with new ideas for recipes, marketing, project concepts, design, artwork, that stuff. I'm not very good at HR, at the cost side of our business, finance, the P&L statements, generating financial reports. And Nick Benz, our CEO, grew from our CFO to our COO to our CEO because he has very complementary skills to Mariah and my skills, and he actually has a Pittsburgh connection. He got his MBA from Carnegie Mellon with my sister, and that's how I met him, was up in Pittsburgh when I was doing a presentation at Carnegie Mellon. And so he's really grown with our company, and his skills don't overlap a lot with mine, which is great. You want diverse skills at the leadership table. And the same can be said for my wife, Mariah. She's more analytical than I am. She's more risk-averse than I am. But she's also very thoughtful and pragmatic about understanding our brand, and that risk and being off-center and creative is a big part of our brand. So while Nick's strengths are more operational and financial, as our CEO, Mariah's are more, she's really the first sounding board that I use to think of, is this an idea that we should consider at Dogfish before I bring it to the table? She and I discuss it at home over the dinner table or over breakfast or whatever before it even goes to Dogfish. So she's very, very great at her job too.
There were two guys who made themselves a fortune writing a book called In Search of Excellence, deciding that what it was that made people successful rather than unsuccessful in the business, companies large or small, it was what they called management by wandering around. Now, do you have a sort of like a six-word definition of what it is that you found to be successful? That's not managing by wandering around?
Right. Well, we say off-centered goodness for off-centered people, and that's our sort of rallying cry or raison d'etre, what our brand stands for and whom we do what we do for, meaning we're going to be off-centered intentionally, meaning we're going to ignore the status quo and try to create a niche in whatever industry we work within, whether it's a hotel, a restaurant, or a distillery. But then who we're doing it for, off-centered people, also means that we're going to be, again, not doing it for the majority of the people. It's not going to be a homogenized, high volume type of product. It's going to be a niche product on the higher end, and we know we're going to be appealing to a smaller subset of people. But I also like their concept of managing by moving around or whatever you mentioned. And in the book, Off-Centered Leadership, I do kind of roam the marketplace for inspiration, and I not only involve the voices of my internal coworkers, the other leaders at Dogfish whom I interview and include in the book, but I go out and interview great mentors and leaders who inspire me, whether it's the woman who's the CEO of Gore Industries, the makers of Gore-Tex, or Pennsylvania Connection, Nick, who's the CEO of Woolrich America.
Yeah, about that, Sam, about that. Do you ever worry about straying too far from your knitting? I mean, you have restaurants, you have a beer garden atop of Italy in Manhattan, you have, now you're aligned with this clothing company, Outdoor Gear.
That's a valid question. If, you know, Dogfish was a public company, I wouldn't be at all surprised if shareholders came to me and said, oh, you should just focus on the most profitable, highest volume component of business, which is your beer. But my feeling is what makes our company distinct and vibrant and stand out in a world of 4,000 breweries is in great part because we're so dynamic and we've found these complementary niche industries in which we can express our creativity, whether it's collaborative clothing line with Woolrich, a distillery, the restaurant project we do with Mario Batali in New York and Chicago called Eataly. They're not big revenue generators for our company, but they give great brand awareness to demographics that might be groups that aren't immediately thinking themselves as hardcore craft beer drinkers. They're foodies or they're outdoorsmen, hunters. But by Dogfish doing these projects in their sweet spot and their comfort zone, it gives these people more confidence to come and visit us in our sweet spot, our comfort zone, which is our core beer business. So these collaborative projects take a lot of time and energy, but they work to enhance our brand and make it distinct in a world where other breweries aren't taking those kind of risks or moving forward and doing those kind of branding endeavors.
Interestingly enough, the Gore Company was one of the companies that Peters and Waterman admired greatly. But one of the things that they said, in addition to management by wandering around, is that successful companies stick to their knitting. In other words, they stay where they're familiar. And you've just said, well, perhaps that's really not so. And that's what leads me to a recommendation that whether you're a beer drinker or not, whether you're interested in the kinds of things that Sam Caligioni has been doing throughout his life or not, this is a book that's 250 pages or something like that, and there's got to be some value in it for you, whoever you are, if you want to be successful, if you want to be sure that, I mean, it's a book I wish I'd read a long time ago.
Well, thank you for your kind words. I do hope people find value in it, and I'm proud to have written it down.
Now, to bring us up to date just quickly on the new, you have a new restaurant launched, somewhere in Delaware that we read about.
Rehoboth.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. So, you know, another sort of collaborative project. This one's between us and the fishermen of certain regions. The name of the restaurant, it's right next to our original brewery restaurant distillery in downtown Rehoboth. The original one's called Dogfish Head Brewings and Eats. Now, right next to that, still using the brewery and distillery adjacent to it, is Chesapeake and Maine, and as you can infer from the name, it's a geographically enamored seafood restaurant where we're sourcing 100% of the seafood we're serving in this restaurant from either the Chesapeake or Maine regions and as direct from the fishermen as possible. A lot of Americans probably don't realize this, but 91% of the seafood sold in American restaurants actually comes from other countries.
Right.
And besides what that means from a carbon footprint or sustainability perspective, it certainly means it's less likely that seafood from other countries is getting onto the table as fresh as possible. So we're working really hard to source the seafood, you know, as sustainably and locally and directly the fishermen of these two regions as we can. This restaurant's also a platform to celebrate the diversity of our distilled spirit business. So it has a world-class cocktail program where we're even kegging up certain cocktails made with our gins and our vodkas and our rums and serving them here. And, of course, it has a wonderful Dogfish Head beer menu as well.
So why a Dogfish Head?
It's a place.
What?
It's a place, isn't it?
Dogfish Head.
Yes, so I realize it's a goofy-sounding name for a brewery. Many of your listeners have probably heard of Hilton Head. Dogfish Head is a jut of land off of mid-coast Maine, a head of land. But we like that it has sort of a whimsical sound to it because we treat beer very seriously, but we don't treat ourselves too seriously. And the whimsical nature of our name, I think, overlaps well with the sort of adventurous creative spirit of what we do.
But you don't really wear that horrible wig when you're in your car.
Sometimes I do. Not on every trip.
Well, Mariah, I'm certainly, I feel your pain.
Well, as they say, Mariah, yeah. Mariah, you're going straight to heaven.
Yeah.
And
she's a saint.
And Sam is not saying where he's going to go, but he's intending to last another 46 years beyond the 46 he's already done. I can't imagine that we won't talk again several more times before the great day in however many years it is when you get to 92 that we'll still be around. But we certainly hope so, because it's always such fun to talk to you and to exchange philosophy.
My pleasure. I enjoyed talking with you both as well, and I look forward to the next chance we get to do so.
Thanks, Sam.
So we certainly hope you found that interesting, and that perhaps you'll even consider going out and buying a copy of the book. And you certainly should make a point of buying Dogfish Head beers, because they're all very interesting, and checking out his new restaurant,
yes.
Maine and Chesapeake. A man of many parties, our friend Sam Caligioni, and we're delighted to have him on the program. And we'll be back with another interesting story right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. We next have Byra Kornfeld and Stephen Massimilla, who are actually a married couple.
Yeah, it took a while to squeeze that information out of them. They were kind of quiet about that.
She's a chef, food writer, and he is a poet painter. And this combination produced a book called Cooking with the Muse that will allow you to compare poetry and recipes. And you'll also be treated to a poetry reading by Stephen.
A couple of poetry readings, actually, I think.
Yes, exactly.
The muse is upon you, and you will certainly be amused. Oh, what a corny pun, Peter.
Terrible.
time to put the people with the really interesting story on the air.
Well, we get a lot of cookbooks. I don't even know how many a week. We always have about 300 review copies in our hallway. But
wow. You must have quite a library.
Well, But yours is very unique. It's called Cooking with the Muse, and the authors are Myra Kornfeld, who is a chef, aren't you?
Yes, and a cooking culinary instructor.
Yes, and Stephen Massimilla, and you are a poet, a writer. Did I read also that you were an artist?
That's correct.
You do everything.
I also took a large number of photographs that are in the book. And I'm a professor.
And you are a professor where?
At Columbia University and the New School in New York City.
Wow. That's exciting right there. How long did it take you to do this book?
Well, I was thinking about that recently. This book was years in the making.
Oh, I'm sure.
How long would you say?
Well, it depends on whether you start from the beginning of its gestation or if you focus on the more intense period, but it goes back many, many years.
The intense period was the last 3.5 years.
Who wants to explain the concept of this book, which is where it starts to be very unique?
I think
we'll both chime in.
If one of us starts and talks a little bit, we agree that the other one would jump in and continue.
Great. It's good. You get along there. Go ahead.
We're still speaking after this project.
Yes. So, concept. What does the reader expect to encounter way beyond a cookbook?
Okay, well, to start with the cookbook, there are 150 recipes, but this book is also a whole lot more.
It's also a book of poetry. It contains hundreds of poems and excerpts. It contains notes on the poetry and history of food and on the literature of food.
And I might add on the poetry, it's both a poetry anthology and a book of original poems.
And there are 200 color photographs.
Oh, the photographs are wonderful. Congratulations.
Yeah,
on those.
I'm trying.
Thank you.
I'm trying to figure out how you got a hold of Keats and asked his permission to reprint him in your book.
Who is that, Keats?
Yes. How did you
know? He's public domain.
Oh, he is.
There were a lot of permissions, but some were public domain.
Well, you cover the history of food and literature, the combination of food and literature, which it's rather amazing. I thought it was interesting, the very first recipe that you encountered was in cuneiform and from Mesopotamia. I mean,
yes,
in the Yale Babylonian tablet.
It's a very old recipe.
And it's for lentils, which we adore.
Allegedly, the site of ancient Mesopotamia is where the Garden of Eden is supposed to
exactly.
be located.
The fertile triangle.
Cradle of civilization, one of the major cradles.
Well, you know, one thing we noticed in the beginning, this book had sort of an organic process in how we put it together. I was always inventing recipes, and Stephen was always inventing poems, and
it occurred to us that our interests were complementary, that a true cook is always a poet of sorts, and that, in a sense, it takes a poet to cook up vibrant ways to write about food.
Uh-huh.
And we realized that the poems and the recipes had a lot in common, and we got to thinking that we could write a book together. And so it's all about the marriage of recipes and poetry and the synergy between the two.
And what was interesting, too, along the way of how it grew organically, the muse is what inspires one, right? So the muse could be the green market. That could inspire recipes and poems. Sometimes poems inspired recipes. At other times, a recipe inspired a new poem.
Or sometimes we would put a poem and a recipe side by side, and that inspired other musings. And as we worked on it over the years, we realized that the pieces would fit together in sequences, and all the poems interlocked like and
kind of like
recipes,
a jigsaw puzzle.
And the photos later, like a whole, like a mural, all the pieces just fit together.
Now, how do you two fit together?
In terms of, well, what one thing we got from this book is that we complement each other. Our skill sets complement each other, and
but you're just friends.
We're very lucky about that, and collaborating, was a real source of inspiration and support for both of us.
Well, do you teach together or anything? How do you know each other?
Oh, we're married.
Okay, well, that was the question. So you're a couple. That's right.
Yes, we are.
And so the book is about the marriage of literature and cooking, or cooking and writing, or poetry and food, and we are also married.
Oh, yeah, well, you must have been pretty stressed out with this research. I mean, it's incredible research in this book. And you don't dodge any of the issues. I mean, you get right. People should expect to be concerned when they're reading this book also with really strong nutritional information.
Absolutely.
We definitely have a strong food philosophy.
Right.
And we noticed that, all through the ages, seems to support our traditional food philosophy. We don't skirt. We went, and it's really representative of the way we feel about food.
Yeah, I mean, you have this section.
The book really advocates a real foods philosophy.
Yes. You have returning to real food is one it's several chapters, but then the ingredients we use in this book and for your recipes, and you're very specific about those. And they're all, and you also, let me throw in another thing, is not only is it good nutrition, but you're also involved with and support sustainability.
we advocate this. You know, we give the gold standard. I mean, you know, the recipes will work, but recipes are as good as the quality of the ingredients, and we really do support local farming and traditional farming practices, like with, you know, with animal food. You know, get your animals that were raised on pasture. It's healthier for you. The food tastes better. It's better for the planet. And we also have traditional techniques. For instance, you know, we advocate traditional fats, slow-cooked stocks. And another thing that we advocate is cooking foods in a way that makes them most digestible, like soaking nuts and legumes. A lot of people don't know that there's something called phytates that are there to inhibit seeds and legumes and nuts from sprouting, but you know, after they're soaked,
right,
for instance, nuts taste so much better after they're dried out. They taste incredibly fresh and they go down easy.
So in all these ways, both in the sourcing and the preparation, the quality of food really matters. And a farmer we know and that whom we trust said, or always said, that cheap food makes expensive medicine, and we
Good.
Agree with that.
Yes.
You know, I wish I had you here because we just discovered a fairly large container of something in our freezer, in one of our freezers, which looks to be something that's supposed to be sprouted, but I'm not sure if it's edible or not.
That's funny.
I don't know how it got, and we can't remember or figure out how it got there.
Well, you know, that might have gotten in there without getting labeled.
No label.
Well, it hasn't been labeled. It looks for all the world like coriander. It looks for all the world like coriander seeds.
Uh-huh.
But how coriander seeds got in the second floor refrigerator, I have no idea.
Freezer, no less, yeah.
Freezer. Cause
so, you don't think that you could possibly forget what you put in your freezer?
I know.
I can forget it. I can forget
you
anything.
But, you know,
well, now let's move on here. That when you get all this basic information, and I should mention that if you get trapped in any way, there's a great bibliography and a great glossary also in this book. But you work your way into the seasons again in a fairly organic way.
Yes, the book is arranged in ways that work together, but one of them is that the ingredients come up in the book at the time when they would be coming into season, and the book is arranged by chapters that follow the seasons.
And
each chapter also seems to more or less follows the course of a meal, starting with starters and soups, moving toward a full meal, and ending with desserts.
Right, and in each chapter we highlight a full feast or two as well.
Extremely seasonal book, and we encourage seasonal eating and eating locally and so forth.
And the poetry really complements that. The poets go, you know, like to write about foods at the height of their ripeness, and there's many, many ingredient-centered poems that really work.
So, for instance, it opens with blackberry poems by Galway Connell and Mary Oliver. And just at that liminal moment between the end of autumn and the end of summer and the beginning of autumn, when the blackberry muse is at the height of her powers, and that's what those poems are about, how the berries are just ripe to bursting, how they're just perfectly ripe at that time, and that's the perfect time to make the blackberry parfait.
It's a very simple dish, but it just highlights the blackberries.
No. Right, and then, you know, but there are so many recipes that follow this philosophy, and because the literature work complements it so well, so there's a finish where the poet
Wang Long... That actually struck me as funny. That was amazing.
And what she says in the poem is that close to your original glory is how I want you. And so with every poem, we find that the poets just celebrate ingredients in their original glory very often.
It's also interesting, and we have in summer, we have a kofta kebab with parsley and sumac onions, and it's common in Sufi poetry for the heart of a lover to be called a kebab.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it's funny. And we have a poem with it called The Banquet from Hafiz, and
well, but really, I think here, this is not just about how the poem is seasonal, but it's about how poetry is also about human relationships and about the relationships between people. Could we read a couple of lines from this poem?
Sure.
What page is it so I can follow?
On page 414.
So this is on page 414.
A short poem.
And it's called The Banquet. And I'll just read a few lines.
Okay.
By Hafiz. And it says, a gathering of good friends, talking quietly outdoors, the banquet being served, a dry rosé with a bit of kebab afterwards.
And then, you know, towards the end it says, the infinite mystery of all this love. If someone doesn't want the pleasure of such an open-hearted garden, companionship, no, life itself, must be against his rules.
Wow. So, a short poem.
I think you started in September because you got the best poetry from Keats right at the very beginning.
Well, Keats is extraordinary. I mean, the sensual way that he writes, and so we have his entire Ode to Autumn in the book with an essay.
Yeah, that's long, yeah.
Right, yeah. As we approach the Thanksgiving phase, we felt that he is really introducing the entire autumn cornucopia. And so it's the movable feast of autumn itself that he presents in that poem. And we also have a Keats poem, The Eve of St. Agnes, which goes with Middle Eastern feast. And in the middle of that poem, in the middle of winter, he recounts how a whole feast emerges from a closet. We don't know how they cooked it, because really it's made by one person and instantly appears out of a closet. But
it was inspirational for our whole Middle Eastern. We love Middle Eastern flavors. So it's a whole Moroccan feast.
Yeah, point out that the recipes are global. I mean, you cross all kinds of national boundaries and areas of the globe. With this.
We do. It's global recipes, global poetry, and then it also inspired us to just pull in so much historical content and interesting tidbits,
so
literary tidbits.
Just as the recipes travel around the globe from Latin America to the North America and all over Europe and India, the Middle East. There's even a poem about eating a mango by a Caribbean poet.
Oh, that one was funny. Wasn't that interesting?
It's wonderful that you...
English girl eats their first mango.
Yes. So,
reverse colonization, you called it.
Yeah,
right,
colonization
exactly.
In reverse, you called it. Because you've got to learn how to eat a mango the way you should really eat a mango. And we explain next to it how to eat a mango in the poet's note.
And we show one of our photos, we show the hedgehog technique for, you know, scraping the mango right off the skin with your teeth.
It was more work than people realized. We had to figure out how to explain this clearly, how to photograph it, and to make sure it was laid out in a clear way. But we really enjoyed the process.
Yeah, and it was definitely for the designer a design puzzle to just lay it out so it all made sense.
Another thing that we're trying to do is not just introduce people to foods that that we think everybody would enjoy even if they don't know about them, because not everybody knows what a sunchoke is or what galangal is and so forth. But we felt that the poetry often also emphasized how a lot of vegetables just don't get enough respect, for instance.
Well, for instance, take, you know, celery root or celeriac, whatever you want to call it.
I love it, celery.
Yeah, exactly. It's a wonderful tasting vegetable. And, you know, I know when I'm teaching people how to use it, a lot of times people are afraid of it because it's so gnarly and ugly.
Exactly, yes. And it's hard to work with, too.
It's hard to work with. You got to get past all those hairy roots and just cut them off to get to the, you know, beautiful tasting inside. And the poem that Stephen wrote that goes with it, I know now I read in my classes because it changes how I look at the celery root. I mean, it's, you know, it's just...
Well, they are really gnarly. I also took a picture in the green market of what they look like, but when they come out of the ground, they're even a little bit more, they're a little bit gnarlier than that because they're all black with the earth all over them and they're awkward. And well, let's just say that a celery root would never win a beauty contest.
But I love that last line where it's hidden in a monster heart.
Well, I was going to, maybe I could read a couple lines of this poem. I don't know how much time we have.
Go ahead.
Maybe two lines at the beginning and at the end.
Go ahead.
Okay, so celeriac, and by the way, the title to me almost sounds like the name of a disease, but it's a beautiful vegetable on the inside. Celeriac, artery twisted on the outside, the torn, blood-draggled glove of a poor ogre's heart, the most pointlessly neglected vegetable. And then I describe how in the winter it's all down in the cellar the whole time among dust-drunken bulbs and really can't feel any of the sun's heat on its flesh. But at the end I say, when this black thing emerged in the winter market, the earth still refused to burn, having turned to stone like the white meat of this root. All its assertive, refreshing flavor hidden in a monster heart.
Now, listeners, you can just...
So it is a beauty queen, but it's an inner beauty queen in disguise.
Well, hold on just a second. I'm going to give you a lead-in now that's going to make people who love beets want to buy this book.
Okay.
because we're not going to say a single word about how you introduce beets. All we will say is, beet lovers, you need to read what they say about that.
You know, one of your admirers wrote a little blow for you. Sarah Moulton hates beets.
Oh, well, that was, but she loved the book. So
she
that,
loved the
so,
book, but she says they taste like dirt. She hates them.
Well, one thing that we mention is that beets are not only to be celebrated for their beautiful blood red lusciousness, but there are also golden beets.
Right.
And you can do a lot with beets to transform them, and we serve this with...
For instance, we have one dish that's a barley risotto with golden beets and black radishes, and the light-colored beets just blend right into the barley and sweeten it, and they completely disappear.
Well,
now, can we make sure of one thing is that you've been hinting at it all. Not only is it marrying poetry and literature with foods and culture, but your recipes are really good.
And oh, they are.
People will
they are really tasty, and one thing I want to say, they are really well tested. They work.
Good. No,
we wanted to make sure that the recipes would be clear and easy to follow for cooks of all levels.
Right. So whether you're an accomplished cook or you're new to cooking, we think you will be able to really follow the recipes.
I mean, there were a very large number of people at cooking events and in classes who...
they've been tested.
And Myra is especially good when people go wrong at incorporating, at learning from that how to steer people in the right direction in the recipe.
As you know, so much about recipe writing is really communication. And
right.
So we were very careful to make it clear.
And if I didn't understand anything, then we explained it again. So even words... You know, we can't assume that everybody is so up on all the terminology. We try to make
he would envision how to cook it in his head, even if he hadn't cooked something, to make sure that he understood it. So we wanted to make sure everyone could really get what we were trying to say.
Well, people talk a lot about coffee table books. I think
is a coffee table book.
Also laced flat, and we hope people will tatter and splatter it as well and really use it.
Actually,
right. One of the people who wrote a blurb for the book.
He wrote that.
We like that.
But we were happy. We were happy about that because it has a cover on it. You can splatter that cover or take it off. But a cookbook should be used, and it should be something that you get, you know, into the trenches with, and it will stay open on the counter.
What I was going to say was, I was struggling to get a word in edgeways.
If you'll
pardon me saying so, I think you've invented a new genre. because, and I was going to say there are coffee table books and there are cookbooks, but this is one of the first dining table books I've ever seen.
I think you invented that.
I can see that.
We could think one person could be making, say, the Tuscan tomato soup, while another person could be, you know, at a moment in the cooking where it's just in the pot, sitting at the dining table reading about the journey that the tomato has taken to get to your plate, you know, because it really is a very interesting history. And so there's a lot here for everyone, we think.
I agree. And I certainly wish you a lot of success. And I'm sure it will be forthcoming on this book. And I don't know where you go from here, because this is such a definitive book. But again, it's Cooking with the Muse, Myra Kornfeld and Stephen Massimilla. And thank you, too, for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much
thank
for having
so
us
much.
On. Really appreciate it.
And we had a good time.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
If you're getting the gist that almost everybody has at least one cookbook in them, you probably are not far from being right. And this one was a surprise. Did you know? And we'll talk to David Geiser to find out. Did you know about what the Vatican cooks, what the popes eat? Here he is, a member of the Swiss Guard, which has historically, for what, 500 years, protected the Pope, thought to write a cookbook. And you can find out what your favorite popes ate and what served at the Vatican. So here we are, David Geiser, The Vatican Cookbook. I'm so excited to be talking to David Geiser. When I first heard that we had such a thing as The Vatican Cookbook, presented by the Swiss Guard, which is the Pontifical Swiss Guard, who've been protecting the Pope for 500 years. The Vatican Cookbook came out originally, I imagine, in Italian. Is that true, David?
Yes, and we are protecting the Holy Father in the Vatican, and we are 110 Swiss Guard, and it's a big honor to protect the Holy Father, to protect the Vatican, and it was amazing.
Well, the subtitle of this is 500 Years of Classic Recipes, Papal Tributes, and Exclusive Images of Life and Art at the Vatican. Now, this book, it came out earlier in Europe, but this is the very first English edition of this book. And you've added some things to it, more photographs. Anybody getting this book will get a whole lot more than just these recipes. You have images of art from the Vatican, and you have, which everybody is probably curious about, the favorite dishes of our last three popes, right?
Right. We have, how you told, we have, it's not only a cookbook, it's more than a cookbook. We have inside the favorite dishes from the last three popes, from the Holy Pope John Paul II. For example, one of his favorite is the pierogi or the apple kuchen. Then we have the Pope Benedict inside with the sausage salad. And we have also from Pope Francis, we have the empanadas, the dulce di leche. And he likes also to eat really the pizzas from Argentina.
He loves pizza, I know.
Yeah, he loves pizza and he loves sweet things. And so it's a book with a lot of stories, with a lot of pictures, a lot of interesting stories from the Vatican. So, yeah, I'm really lucky about this.
Historically, for like 500 years, the Swiss Guard has guarded the Pope, but we didn't know, I guess, that they were actually, were they also in charge of the Vatican kitchen? I mean, it seems like it. Or were you simply borrowing what you knew about what was going on in the kitchen?
I'm not sure if I understand the question right, but in the Vatican, the sisters and the Holy Father, the Francis, live in a private hotel, you could say, and their sisters cook for Francis, and Benedict lived before in the Pope, in the Holy Pope Palace, and there are, it was, the situation was a little bit other.
Uh-huh.
Was that the question?
What you were the, not only just, your family was, three generations in the Swiss Guard, but you were the one who were, you were trained in food. You are a chef, a practicing chef. So, so it was your idea to do this book, huh?
Yep. And I was a normal Swiss Guard in my time, and this book was created in the free time. And the idea came from the commander, Daniel Enrich. He asked me to write a cookbook, and the story is, at first I wrote in Switzerland. I had very lucky, I was very young, I wrote two bestsellers, and then on the record stay in Switzerland, the commander asked me, hey, why you want to go to the Swiss Guard? You have success in Switzerland, you could do more. And I told him, for me it's more important that I could do my dreams, and it was always a dream to go to the Swiss Guard. And then he asked me to write a cookbook together with the Swiss Guard. And so the idea was born in Switzerland on the recruits day for the Swiss Guard.
You know, I'm trying to remember. I used to know the uniforms that you wear as a Swiss Guard. Now, they are based on something historical, but I can't remember what. Where does that come from?
Yeah. A lot of people think that the uniforms are created by Michelangelo, and that's a legend. These uniforms, and the story from the Swiss Guard is 500 years old, and the uniforms changed with every pope in the stories a little bit. And 1914, the new commander in this time, Jules Robin, created this new uniform, and it's he was inspired about Raphael, about Michelangelo, and it's a legend that Michelangelo and Raphael created this uniform, but it's a funny story.
It doesn't look very comfortable, David.
It's like a military uniform. Normally, it's not to walk and to go to shopping, or I don't know. So it's more comfortable in a jeans and in a t-shirt, but it's not bad, and it's okay to stay and to protecting the Holy Father. So it's a well uniform.
Well, this book makes me homesick for Rome. There are some unusual recipes in here. Tell us about this Grittebanse.
The Grittebanse, that's a special story from Switzerland. In Switzerland, in the Advent time, it's a tradition that we make this Grittebanse. And that's something, really something special, traditional from Switzerland, and we eat this normally if the Santa Claus came to the children on the 6th December, then we eat this Grittebanse.
Yeah, and it means bow-legged bedding, it says here.
And it's very easy to make it at home. Uh-huh. It's very easy and very fine.
What's on the menu at the Vatican changes with each pope.
Yeah. Every person like a little bit another food, and also the Pope has different tastes, and so the kitchen or the favorites changes with every Pope a little bit.
But there are some really classic Roman recipes here. salt in boca, jump in your mouth.
Salt in boca, jump. Exactly. That's a typical recipe from Rome. It's an old tradition, I think, more than 1,000 years old, and it's the favorite from the Bishop Gens when he is responsibilization for the house of the pontifical. Yes, he was the private secretary from Pope Benedict, and he is a really important man in the Vatican and a really good man.
Well, you know, looking at the recipes, I can tell sometimes what pope they come from, such as Wiener Schnitzel. That has to be Pope Benedict's favorite.
Wiener Schnitzel?
Yeah.
No, Wiener Schnitzel is from Cardinal Kurt Koch. He is the Swiss cardinal, and for us Swiss people, important. And he loves the simple kitchen, and he loves really the simply things. And Pope Benedict loves this sausage salad and the Kirschmichel. That's something from Munich. He loves this also, and yeah, Benedict likes also the sweet things with a lot of sugar and yeah.
Yeah, well, I hear that Pope Francis's doctors are very, very insistent that they curb the sweet things and the pizzas and so forth that Pope Francis wants to eat.
Yeah, he likes to eat well, and he likes to eat things like that, and yeah, if he likes it, it's well if he eat it.
Now, this section here is called Life in the Swiss Guard. I think we all would like to know a little bit about what it is like to actually be in the Swiss Guard. What's your life like in the Swiss Guard?
Yes, the first or the important point is protecting the Holy Father. And we are more or less like the Secret Service for the Holy Father, like the Secret Service protecting the President of America. And that's the first point. And then we have also to protecting the Holy Father on his travels. We have to control the different ways to the Vatican, to go inside to the Vatican. We have to look for the apostolic palace. We have a lot of different jobs, and it's very interesting, and it's a big honor to be to end. I'm really
how
sorry.
Long? How long? Usually,
yeah, you have to. The minimum is 2 years. You could be a Swiss cop for minimum 2 years, and then after these 2 years, you could make you could be a Swiss guard till 25 years. You could after
really?
Marry in the Vatican, and you could have a family, and then you have an apartment, and if you want make this career, you could make this till 25 years. But the normal Swiss guard make it for 2 or maybe for 3 years. And then they go back in Switzerland because we have the family at home, we have the friends, and it's a perfect experience.
Now, where is the first chapel of the Swiss Guard?
The first chapel is, yes, it's a little bit depend from which part. If you go the normal way, the important way is the entry of St. Anna, the gate of St. Anna, and there is the St. Anna Church. Then we have also from the other side churches, or if you came from the square, the first church is the Peter's Basilica. So you have, and inside the Vatican, also inside the Vatican Garden, we have on different places different important chapels, but they are more or less all private. The Vatican is a private country, and for the tourists, the square is open, the church, the basilica is open, but more or less the rest is private.
I see. Now, does the Vatican give state dinners? Like, if President Obama visits the Vatican, do they do a big dinner for him?
Yeah, every week we have three, like more or less three presidents, which one visits the Holy Father. So it's really a lot of presidents inside the Vatican. And sometimes it's also dependent. The president meet the Holy Father in the morning or in the afternoon, and sometimes they are for one night in the Vatican. That's always a little bit other. So you could not say it's always like the same thing. And yes, in my time, Obama was in the Vatican, Putin was in the Vatican, I could meet Queen. That's also a really big honor to be then in the Vatican and to see people like our presidents, so important presidents. That was also a big honor.
Wow. Well, the cookbook is beautiful. It gives you a lot of the culture of the Swiss Guards and of the Vatican, a lot of the art, which is clearly amazing. And you can share a little bit of it. Try doing St. Martin's goose. That looks hard. I thank you. You've given us a good insight into the Vatican with this book. And I wish you well on your book tour. And I'd like to have the risotto and artichokes with my goose. David, it's been a pleasure talking to you, and congratulations on production of this book.
Thank you. You too. It was nice to be in your radio.
Great. Thank you.
Welcome.
Ciao.
Have a nice day.
Ciao.
Bye.
Time flies when you're having fun, they say. The hour has flown by. Our show is over for the day. We hope you will join us again, same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye-bye.